Last week, how would you summarize the book of Colossians as kind of an overview? What seems to be some of the problems? What is Paul addressing?
From what you said last week, they were trying to wrap their minds and the concept of Jesus, I mean, just God in general. Couldn't believe that he would have been there in the flesh.
Yeah, that's a part of it, just kind of wrapping their minds around that.
Right, they just didn't understand the concept that he would, I guess, lower himself to that level.
Yeah, because God is holy, pure, without sin. Therefore, their minds were looking at anything that was physical had to be evil. And Jesus became a man, therefore he hadn't become evil, and that's mind-boggling, would be to them. Would be to me, too, if I held that belief that all matter is evil. And that's kind of when sometimes we talk about dualism. Okay, and it's trying to make that total separation of the physical world from the spiritual world. One's holy, the other's evil. And how do you mesh the two together? You don't with that understanding. Because it doesn't fit.
I think just the first 8 verses you talked about was Paul making emphasis on Christ. And I think you mentioned about the focus of the book on Christ, the translation to the church.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, even those first 8 verses, it was obvious that Paul was making that tie between God and Christ. So.
Yeah. And I do believe that's how he is logistically doing that. I think he is very careful in the language that he's chosen. And again, I make sometimes assumptions based on my understanding of the book. It may be more general in nature, but I see like using Jesus at a particular time, Christ in a particular way, meaningful to the argument that he's trying to make. And that is, Jesus is God. He did become man. He walked among us, as John would say, in 1 John chapter 1, beginning.
It's like attacking them without attacking them.
It's really it. And
he wasn't doing it in a confrontational way.
Yeah.
But yet.
And you're very skilled when you're able to do that. I mean, even today when we're dealing with people with certain issues, we don't want to overlook that. We want to address it poignantly. But at the same time, we don't want to drive folks away, because that's not going to help anything. And I think that's what he's doing.
Well, Christians for years, have heard that they are in the world, but not part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he's trying to tell them here about Christ.
Yeah.
He was, but he was not evil as you count worldly things.
Right. So we have a mixture of what world beliefs, if you will, at this time. Remember we talked about last time? We've got Gnosticism, which is kind of a blend of, I believe, Judaism, not in its purest form, but as it had evolved to this point. Eastern religions. Yeah, a lot of mysticism going on. Okay.
Greek philosophy.
Yes, yeah, very much so, influenced by Greek philosophy and the philosophers at that time. And then Christianity. Okay. And just think about taking all of that, sticking in a blender, blending it, and what you get. I mean, it would have to be confusing, even trying to figure that out. It's almost like premillennialism today, trying to figure that out, make sense of it.
But Christianity was something new to them.
Mm-hmm.
This other stuff was something they grew up with.
Yeah. Yeah. And from their individual background. Yeah, their perspective. Very good. Very good. Let's pick up with verse 9, chapter 1, and we're still looking at the doctrinal section, okay? And he says, for this reason, goes back, I believe, to verses 3 through 6, the latter part, really in verse 8, where he says, you also, who also declared to us your love in the Spirit, I believe it's love motivated by the Spirit, through the Spirit's teaching, how they were to love Christ, to love one another. So here's a positive point. So for that reason, based on their love, we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you. Idea of pray without ceasing, right? So he's praying for them. Let me give you this just as an outline for yourself. You might entitle it Paul's Prayer, which would be a prayer for all Christians. And I'm just going to briefly run through, then we'll go back and we will look at the verses. And the first point is, he asks that they may be filled with all the knowledge of his will and all wisdom and spiritual understanding. Basically, to be filled with knowledge and spiritual understanding. Number two, verse 10, that you may have a walk worthy of the Lord, which we all want, and we want that for our brothers and sisters. In verse 11 is point three, that they would be strengthened with all might, spiritual strength. And verse 12 is number four, giving thanks to the Father. Because we would pray that other people would give thanks to the Father, especially our brothers and sisters. Now, let's go back. He says that he did not cease to pray for them and to ask, literally to beg. Okay, so this is a serious matter. Okay, so Paul is taking what's happening in Colossae, in Laodicea, Hierapolis, in that area, I think even spilling over into Ephesus, what's going on in that area, very serious. Okay, it's a serious matter. So I'm begging that you would be filled, literally supplied, that God would supply them with the knowledge of his will. And anything ring a bell there? Is what we've been looking at? What do we say about the Gnostics? And literally, what does the root of that word mean?
Gnosis, knowledge.
Gnosis, knowledge, exactly. So he starts to be filled with knowledge. Now, the word that's chosen here means full knowledge. Okay. The Gnostic says, we got it. Okay, you don't have it. You need to come to us and you'll get some of this. Paul's saying, wait a minute. I'm praying that God will fill you with this knowledge. Not the Gnostics, not some, you know, mystical religion. But this is to come from God. So I ask that you may be filled, supplied with the full knowledge of His will. What God wants you to do. In all wisdom and spiritual understanding. Okay? The Gnostics were high on wisdom, right? And especially the philosophers. The Greek philosopher. And we'll get to the word philosophy, which literally means what?
Love of wisdom.
Yeah, love of wisdom. Yeah. And it's almost not the way that they kind of created it. It wasn't just wanting to be wise, but it was just the love of talking about wisdom. Okay. Just kind of debating these issues. Okay. Wisdom is the proper use of knowledge. And I believe as it's used in the Bible, it's the proper use of knowledge that brings God glory, which is going to be beneficial to us. So he's talking about real wisdom here. The truth that comes from God, and now the ability to use that, to live that out in life. And spiritual understanding. Understanding there means critical knowledge. We often talk today about critical thinking, which I think is important. Well, Paul was even talking about it back then. Because they're not being critical about what's going on there. They should be. They should be questioning what's being taught. So he said, I want God to help you with that. And you will have this full knowledge, that you will have wisdom, and you'll have spiritual understanding, critical judgment on what's taking place. That you may walk worthy of the Lord. The word worthy there is an interesting word. It really has to do with balance. You have scales and you try, you know, put 5 pounds over here and you maybe pour out some flour or something. You want that to be balanced. You know, I want money's worth. Okay. Here he's really talking about that you may walk in a balanced way, okay, of the Lord. In other words, it's almost saying, because this comes out of what he's just talked about, here is God's will, what he wants you to do, how he wants you to live life, wants you to have this wisdom so you can properly live out that knowledge, Okay. This is, let's just call it God's standard. Okay. Then you think, okay, with your life, I want it to be balanced. You know, not that here's the standard and I'm way down here, I'm not living up to it. Nor the other way where I'm like Jonah trying to outrun God. Okay. But just balance. I love that word. I mean, if you spend much time with me, you'll hear me use that word a lot, because I think folks are just out of balance a lot of times, even in the church. And we often talk about, you know, liberalism. I think there's another problem with legalism. And the whole thing is just people out of balance. I say, hey, let's just do what God says. I'm not trying to add more to it or take away from it. There's enough there. And when we do it God's way, we are complete people. We can enjoy life, enjoy Christianity, and enjoy one another. It's when we get out of balance. It's like a car. A tire gets out of balance. It's not running well, right? So he wants them really to be balanced, to live a life that is really congruent with God's will, God's thinking, okay? Fully pleasing Him, and that is the life that fully pleases Him, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. Okay? It's only when we have God's knowledge, His Word, and live according to it, that we can really be fruitful. That we can live that productive life and increase in knowledge. Yes?
You know, it's interesting that talking about them being fruitful and balanced here. When you think about the Greek thought, I mean, you know, Paul said in Romans 1:21 that they went inside into vain reasoning. Mm-hmm. You know, it was of no profit. And just that, you know, the Greeks would think, well, is that really real? You know, there would be some things that would be that really wouldn't have any application to life. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't help you out. And today you still have that same problem. I mean, like, think about agnosticism. Mm-hmm. How does that help somebody live their life, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the Bible gives us practical wisdom to apply to our lives, you know, mm-hmm. to be balanced and bring forth fruit.
Yeah.
There's quite a contrast in the true wisdom and this false wisdom that they were having.
Yeah, and the other is just a waste of time, waste of energy, mm-hmm. a waste of life. Yeah, very good observation. It's said that, you know, as Paul went into Athens, you know, some of the debate would be around how many angels could God put on the head of a pin. Why that makes any difference? And who knows? But just debate that issue. Yeah. So here's something with substance. Yeah.
I think that sometimes when you go into it, just knowledge for knowledge's sake, mm-hmm. is that you accumulate all this, but if there's no fruit, or it's not either in yourself or and with others, there's a little benefit been gained by mm-hmm. accumulating all this.
Exactly. Don't we sometimes see folks sitting in a Bible class year after year after year, accumulating knowledge, but what do they ever do with it? Kind of scratch your head at times, don't you? Kind of wonder what's going on, because it's almost, in the sense of philosophy, the love of wisdom for the sake of love of wisdom. Here's the love of knowledge for the sake of, I just want to gain some more knowledge.
Those ever learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth, you know,
yeah.
they're never going to apply it to their life. Or, you know, well, I'm still not sure about that. You know, you can't know that for 100%, and mm-hmm. so they never get around to obeying the Lord.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just kind of like, the rubber meets the road, and let's just get out here and apply it. Yeah, and enjoy it. And I think that's what Paul is doing with them here. He says in verse 11, well, let me add this to it. Looking at the balanced life, here he's looking at the balanced life, the manifestation of it, the outward expression of that balanced life. They're fruitful, right? And when we're balanced, we are fruitful. Begin verse 11, he looks at it inwardly. Okay. Strengthened with all might. I think he's talking about spiritual strength. It's almost kind of the idea of taking on the whole armor of God that we'll be able to stand. We take that stand. I think that's what he's talking about here. Because they would need that, especially dealing with Gnosticism, anything that would come their way. They need that spiritual strength, but they wouldn't yield to it. According to His glorious power, God's power, for all patience and long-suffering with joy. Okay. And isn't that the way sometimes it is with the Christian life? Being patient, being long-suffering. Yeah, I kind of want it right now. And I have to be patient, allow God to work in my life. I need to stay strong. But notice, it's in, if you will, the atmosphere of joy. Now, where does the joy come from?
Hope.
Yeah, it's having that hope. It's knowing that God is working in our lives because, again, this is a part of this prayer, that it's God intervening in their lives. Not in a miraculous way, just in a way, a providential way to strengthen them. Therefore, I'm in a right relationship with God. There is joy and peace. In verse 12, giving thanks to the Father, who has qualified us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light. Now, what's he talking about in verse 12? Just kind of summing it up in your own words. When you look at the word qualify, what kind of jumps out at you?
Rendered fit.
Pardon me?
Rendered fit.
Rendered fit. And with the tense there, I like the way you did it. It's rendered, not you will be, you are. So, as he's saying this, that he who has qualified, and the Greek tense are different tenses. Aorist tense just basically means past tense. It's happened. So something happened in the past, he's saying. And at that point, you were qualified. It's not, we got to wait and meet with these Gnostics, and you know, not that they would be calling them Gnostics at that time, but these people with this superior knowledge and understanding. We're just going to have to take some classes from them and sit at their feet until finally we're qualified. No, you're already there. You're already qualified to be partakers. Somebody else involved, right?
Yes.
Partakers of the inheritance. Ultimately, heaven itself, right? Mm-hmm. And we'll have an inheritance someday. All those blessings that are coming from God. Of the saints. And a saint means what?
Christians.
Christian.
Believers.
A believer set apart. Right. One sanctified. Okay. Which means the sin problem's already been taken care of. It's not sometime in the future. It's not as the Gnostics would be saying, you know, eventually with this enlightenment, and you gain this superior knowledge, you'll finally be up there and take care of that sin problem. No, it's already taken care of. Okay? We already have that. Yeah.
Do you think this is addressing Christians at all phases? I mean, is it a new Christian's receiving the same, they're rendered qualified, or whatever the term was used,
mm-hmm.
as well as those who are mature Christians? I mean, they're still.
Yeah.
That you're saying they don't, the thing about the International Church of Christ, they feel like you have to disciple people before they become Christians.
But yeah.
You're saying that's not, there's no path.
No. And I think what he's going to, well, what he is going to work into is their baptism. Yeah. This is just early phase of it, just kind of setting the stage for what I'm going to share with you in a moment. Something took place back there that qualified you, and at that moment, you were a saint. I think he's saying baptism. Yeah.
It's interesting to contrast it with what you're talking about as far as full knowledge, or you know, the present tense of growing in the knowledge, or the epignosis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're supposed to grow in it, but their growing in knowledge didn't make them any more qualified or made fit. They were made fit first by obedience to the gospel.
Yes.
And then they continued to grow after that. But you know, it wasn't like, oh, I'm more forgiven now because I have more knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
excellent point.
Them, you know, but then they grow in knowledge after that.
So. Yeah, and where from the Gnostics' perspective, it would be progressive till you finally get there.
Yeah.
Other place, you're already there, and it just continues from that plane. Yeah, great observation. So, he talks about this inheritance in the light, and I think the light there is used on purpose because of, again, the Gnostics' idea of enlightenment. And that kind of that terminology is still floating around, isn't it? Then he says, he has delivered, past tense. Well, let me share with you the last point. I told you to a balanced life is to look upward, inward, and this, or outward, inward, and this point was upward, looking to God, because the balanced life is looking to God. Then he talks about the giving thanks to the Father, giving thanks to the Father for the inheritance, but also in verse 13, is because he has delivered us from the power of darkness. Okay, so he delivered them, which means he transferred them from the power of darkness. And again, the way that the Gnostics and even other religions they would often look at the spiritual realm, okay, and the things that are way out there, and they kind of fit into mysticism and all like that, and then the physical realm, okay, spiritual and physical. But I think a better way to look at that is the spiritual is everywhere, and the physical is just a part of all of that, okay. Because here we are in the physical world, and we pray to God, and never says, okay, way up there's the spiritual or whatever. Even talks about angels serving us and everything like that, so I'm not sure they're way out there. It's probably just a different dimension that we can't see. And it's almost like when the prophets in the Old Testament were allowed to see, wasn't it Elijah or Elisha? Elijah wasn't. I was able to see the chariots of God. They were just kind of everywhere, weren't they? So I think that was enabling him to see into another dimension, into the spiritual dimension. So what he talks about here is this spiritual world, a part of it is wicked. So he says he has translated us, transferred us from the power of darkness, which would be the power of sin, but also from a spiritual perspective, the spiritual, well, the best way to look at that is, look over here in Ephesians, where he says in chapter 2, he has made us alive who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of the world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. Almost the wicked spiritual forces that we can't see, but they're there, and we are influenced by it, but we've been translated out of that because we were a part of it. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'll say more about that in just a moment. We're just getting that concept down. He has delivered us from the power of darkness and translated us, transferred us into the kingdom of the Son of His love. Okay. So the Son has a kingdom. Now, the word here is basileia. And often when we look at kingdom, what normally comes to our mind? The church. And I don't debate that at all, because it is. They're often used synonymously. But at the same time, they are different words. Ecclesia versus basileia. Okay. So when we just then think about kingdom, how do we often describe it, illustrate it?
Church.
Okay, the church, but I'm looking for something other than the church. As we just look at the word in a general sense, kingdom, what comes to mind?
God's territory.
A territory. Yeah, we often think of territory, don't we?
Citizens.
Yeah, citizens of a territory, getting ready. But probably a better way of looking at basileia is authority, power, reign. Reign and sovereignty, really at the heart of basileia, kingdom. Okay. Now,
how that works together with the church is there is Jesus' reign, his kingdom, and the church often synonymously is used as one and the same, right? Because Jesus exercises authority over the church, which is his kingdom. But not to blow your mind, the kingdom, basileia, is greater than the church.
Because our other spiritual things. So.
Exactly. So if you will, this would be the church part of kingdom, basileia. But it talks about rulers and principalities and powers. It talks about King of kings and Lord of lords over the whole world, right? Okay. But they're not all in the church. So there are times when church and kingdom are synonymously used, and that's all that he has in mind. But there are other times when kingdom has a broader meaning. Okay, I just want to share that with you. Now, here, he is talking about the church, but I wonder if he's not just at this point talking about transferring from one power to another, which in fact, the latter power, the kingdom of Christ, is greater than all of it, because he's going to go on to say, all this stuff that you're concerned about, Jesus is Lord, King, Master over all of it. Yes?
Usually we use this verse to talk about when the kingdom came.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that kind of against this context?
No, you could use that. Yeah, and I'm not, you know, saying, you know, this isn't talking about being transferred into the church. I think it is. But I think it can be even greater than that. In other words, delivered us from the power of darkness and translated us into the kingdom of his dear son. I think in this context here, the kingdom is talking about the church, and he's going to go on to develop that. But I want us just to look at kingdom as not just talking about church. I want us to remember it as sovereignty, as reign.
We was under the dominion of darkness before, then we were translated to the dominion of God's Son.
Right.
Which is the church, mm-hmm. but also that all that that he encompasses beyond that.
Right. And that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
His reign is beyond that, but here he's talking about the special part of it, the church, translate us into it. Okay.
Yeah, but that's not the restriction of God's reign. I mean, God's over all.
Exactly, right.
So I told about 2 weeks ago, the same picture you did, exactly, that the minister was here, mm-hmm. talking privately about, that was his same sort of thought, that sometimes it's kind of hard for us as Christians to get thinking about that, but we mm-hmm. agree that God's over all.
He's over all.
But all is not in the church.
That's it, yeah.
If he's over all, how are we translated into the kingdom? Because aren't we part of the all, even when we're lost?
Right. So, I think the way that he's using it here, where he identifies that the kingdom of the Son of his love, I think at that point he is talking, identifying the special part of his kingdom, his reign. Because in this sense, it would be used synonymously with the church. Because these are the people that subject themselves to his will. They honor his reign. Where before, yeah, we were still a part of his kingdom, but in the realm of darkness. But he's translated us into the special usage of the word. Does that make sense? Okay.
I think that, you know, the idea of territory doesn't really fit the spiritual things like you're talking about.
That's it.
I mean, what I did is, how does location factor into the spiritual realm? You know, here or there in location doesn't mean anything in the spiritual realm.
Yeah.
So.
And that's the only way that we can illustrate it, because that's what we have sensory picked up in life.
Yeah.
because we look at things and we can see territory and we can draw lines. But unlike you, spiritually, I'm not sure there are those lines per se. It is a spiritual movement.
Well, it's the God, popular mind is just like in the situation with Job and Satan. God was still reigning over Satan.
Mm-hmm.
He had him under his control, but he was not serving God.
Right.
I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of...
It was, yeah, it does. And I thought that's what we're talking about, that spiritual realm. Yeah.
But it has to be the more limited sense
here
because
yeah.
If it was the more general sense, it would make no sense that they've been translated out of something.
Right? No, right, right. So just wanted you to be aware of the broader usage of that idea, kingdom oscillator. But here he identifies what he's talking about, and he is going to go on to define it, talking about the church, which is his body. He says, in whom we have redemption. What does it mean to be redeemed?
Bought back.
So he's bought us back. Through his blood, the forgiveness of sins, or the release of sins. Again, I think that is to counter what the Gnostics were saying. Okay, come to them, get the superior knowledge, then ultimately you can get the forgiveness of sins because Jesus isn't enough. He just isn't enough. Here he says, oh, he is enough. And he made the ultimate sacrifice. Any questions as we leave this section? Okay. Moving right along. We're getting into the section that's going to be looking at the preeminence of Jesus. That he's first place above everything else. And let me share with you, first of all, we'll go back and look at it then. 10 points of supremacy. However you want to define it. We're going to look at 10 points and really look at Jesus' preeminence or his superiority. In verse 15, number 1, he is the image of the invisible God. We'll go back and look at these. Number 2, he's the firstborn over all creation. That's why he has preeminence. Verse 17, he is before all things. Again in 17, in him all things consist. Verse 18, he is the head of the body, the church. Number 16, verse, who is the beginning? Number 7, same verse, he's the firstborn from the dead. Number 8 in verse 19, in him all the fullness should dwell. Verse 20, number 9, reconcile all things to himself. And number 10 is verse 20, to present you or us holy, blameless, and irreproachable in his sight. And that'll preach. Going back and looking at verse 15, he, and that's talking about Jesus, is the image of the invisible God. The word image there, everybody's got a computer, you got one. Got little icons. That's the word, icon. Okay. It's kind of looked at differently now, but back then it was the likeness or the manifestation. So Jesus was the likeness or manifestation of the invisible God. In other words, there's God, couldn't see him, but here's Jesus and you could see him because he was that likeness and that manifestation to make known. And he is the firstborn over all creation. Prototokos is the Greek word there, which doesn't mean he was created, but the idea of this word, it means priority and rank.
It means to be preeminent. That's what we're talking about. In other words, he says Jesus is the firstborn, or he is preeminent over all creation. Ranks over all of it. Okay. And if you think, firstborn, used a lot of times in the Old Testament, it wasn't always used as, okay, this is the first one born. But it meant the one who had preeminence over the other sons. Okay. And often you'll have a shift where there will be a firstborn, but the other one will get the right of the firstborn. Okay. And that's the same idea here.
Okay. I've got Joseph. Like Reuben, right?
Yeah, exactly. Same idea. Mm-hmm. And then he says in verse 16, "For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible." Now, that attacks dualism. Invisibles, the spiritual, the visible, the physical. Well, he's over all of it. It doesn't matter to him as it mattered to the Gnostics. Okay, because they made a big deal over the physical versus the spiritual. But he is over all of it, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. There's a lot of debate. What are we talking about here? Are we talking about the rankings among the angels? We're talking about the hierarchy in the spiritual world, or are we talking about earthly rulers and principalities and powers? I don't know that the debate's ever going to be settled, so I think maybe he's just talking about both. From either perspective, he's overall, whether it be angels or something out there in the spiritual realm that we don't know about, or here on earth that we do know about. It doesn't matter. He's over all of it. And all things were created through him and for him, which means he is the agent and the goal of creation. Now here's an interesting point. Not that I get tore up about or anything like that, but often we say the earth was created for whom?
For man.
For man. I wonder if that's what that verse is saying. It's saying it was created for Christ. But we share in that. So, the way it's reading here, it says all things were created through him and for him, which would include the earth. And I think a part of God's plan would be, okay, man will be a part of it and should live for me always, but it's not going to happen. So in a special way, through Christ, they can enjoy the earth.
It kind of answers the question, why did God choose to create it? You know, said it was not. You know, people always ask, you know, what's the point of this? Why did God create it instead of just choosing not to have anything?
Yeah. Yeah. And all that this says, Christ. Yeah. So there's a lot in there that we struggle with and probably will never fully figure out. But this seems to be very specific in the agent, Jesus, creating it, and the goal, himself, in creation. And verse 17 says, "And he is before all things," which speaks of his what?
Pre-existence.
Yeah, pre-existence. He was before. So he wasn't a created being, as they thought, because God's going to have to somehow create this down the road. Remember the demigods and all like that? Eons? But, yes?
Is this before in time or primary in position, as far as rank? I mean, to say somebody is before somebody else. Like, for instance, Jesus was, and John, Jesus was said to be before John the Baptist. Now, mm-hmm. In a sense, chronologically he was, because he's from the beginning. But, you know, more exactly, he's in position. He's before, mm-hmm. Right?
It could be. You know, I've always looked at it as his eternality, that he was before all things. Okay. Just as it's dealing with all things were created through him and for him, and those things, he existed before them. being the agent and goal. And I see what you're saying. Yeah. And in him all things consist, which literally means to hold together. So all things consist. He holds it together. We call that what? Gravity. In a sense. Kind of gravity kind of keeps things. I've always wondered about this. We look in 2 Peter chapter 3 of the annihilation of the world and everything like that, and kind of wonder how it's going to be. What if it's like this? Jesus just stops holding things together. And just imagine what the atoms would do without being held together. That bombardment and all like that. I don't know. Maybe that's how it will all end.
A lot of similarities between this and Hebrews 1.
Oh, yes.
He's, you know, the express image of God and holds all things together. He's so much better than the angels.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and if we had time, we would go there and look at that, because that's, you know, pertinent to what we're looking at here. It's the same wording and everything. Very good point. He says then in verse 18, and he is the head of the body. Okay. Head means what?
In charge.
In charge, yeah. That's simply what he's saying. He's the head, the authority, one in charge of the body. Okay. That's interesting. He uses the word body, and he's going to go on to tell them, well, we're talking about the church. Because the Gnostics really didn't like that idea of body, did they?
No.
Because body is what?
Physical.
Physical and sinful. No, it's not really that way. He's saying because we are that body. The church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. Now, he is the head of the body, the church. And the church being the called out ones, which really goes back to this idea of being translated. Okay, called out of the world of sin, but it's also called into something, and that is into the church. And again, talking about Jesus, who is the beginning. What do you think he's talking about there, dealing with the beginning?
He was there from the start.
Okay. He was there from the start. I think he's already established that. And being there, he has become, pardon?
He's the origin.
He's the origin. The source. The source. Yeah. I think the word is arche, which deals with that idea of source, origin. Okay. So it didn't just evolve, as some would think today, but it had a beginning and it had a source, and that was Jesus. And he's the firstborn, which takes us back and reminds us of verse 15, the firstborn from the dead. And again, I think he's again talking about preeminence. Firstborn from the dead. A couple ways this can go. That he's the first one to be resurrected, never to die again. That would certainly be appropriate. That may be what he's talking about. Or he may be saying, of all people that have ever been resurrected, or all that will ever be resurrected, you'll always have first place.
It's definitely the most important resurrection, right?
Most important resurrection, yeah. And because of his resurrection, we're guaranteed a resurrection. Yeah. Kind of takes us back to John 5:28. You're there. That when he returns by his power, he will call all people from the grave. So it may have something to do with that as well. That in all things he might have the preeminence. Okay, there's a word. And I think a part of what he's saying here is, as it was mentioned there, being the firstborn from the dead, having that preeminence, that in all things he might have the preeminence. So much hinges on the resurrection of Jesus, doesn't it?
Everything does.
Yeah, exactly. So that may be what he's talking about as well. Any questions, comments? Okay. He says in verse 19, and it pleased the Father that in him all the fullness should dwell. Now, when he talks about this fullness should dwell,
The idea of dwelling is to permanently dwell. Okay. So in Jesus, all the fullness of what he's talking about dwells permanently in Jesus. Now, what do you think he's talking about? The fullness. I think he's talking about fullness of God that dwelled in Jesus permanently. Okay. And this goes against the idea, remember, I think it was the Docetics, that the Docetics of Corinthians, one of them, remember, said that when Jesus was baptized, the Spirit came down on him, the deity, if you will, I think that's Corinthians. And then at his crucifixion, just when he said, "Into your hands I commend my spirit," then the deity left him. Well, here you're saying, no, it was the fullness of it dwelled in him.
Okay. Yes. You seem to have trouble, you know, taking this and also Philippians 2, where he empties himself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, certainly there are things that, for instance, Jesus didn't know the day or the hour
mm-hmm.
you know, the end of the world would be when he was here on earth. You know, certain limitations he took on.
Right.
So, I mean, all the fullness of God dwelt in him, even in his earthly...
And I think part of what you're talking about there is God being God can, by virtue of being God, limit himself to certain areas of knowledge. And I think that's what Jesus did. Being God, fully divine, he limited himself to, it may have been just during that time, of when his second coming would be. Which wouldn't be out of character, because that would be something within the power of God to do. So I don't think Jesus ever relinquished his deity.
No.
But same time, he could limit himself in certain areas. And I think a part of it was just being a human being was a form of a limitation.
Couldn't have been possible. It was a matter of roles. But the Father knew the time.
Yeah.
And Christ, that was within God, the Father's purview.
Mm-hmm.
Christ could have known, didn't need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I believe roles are laid out within the Godhead in Scripture.
Right. Yeah, I do too. I believe that.
Mm-hmm. I've always wondered, could that have been a possibility? That was the role the Father's playing, and Christ left it his purview, didn't take away from his deity or anything.
Right. Yeah. And I kind of believe when he got back there that he knew when it would be.
He may have.
Yeah.
Similar to how the Holy Spirit would not be the originator of truth, but could pass along, you know.
Right. The Holy Spirit didn't come to die for the sins of mankind. The eternal Word did. So it's a matter of roles within the God.
But it's kind of hard to imagine how God is God and yet he doesn't know everything.
Right. Because again, we're looking at it from our perspective, because if I know something, I know it. So don't tell me I don't know it, because I know it. But God apparently, and again, that may have been something that was unique to the Father of knowing that time. Being almost the author of the scheme of redemption, Jesus being a part of that scheme, limited himself in knowing that. You were going to?
No, I was saying, you know, I think it was several self-imposed limitations on Christ.
Yeah.
Such as him suffering pain,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the thirst, hunger, you know, all the human aspects, mm-hmm. he had to limit himself to experience those things.
Yeah, and that was becoming a man, yes.
Because, I mean, if he hadn't, there would be no, the temptations would not have existed, and would not be able to relate to us and those things. And I didn't think about any miraculous sorts of things. He chose those times which he used them
mm-hmm.
to his own benefit as well as to others. So,
yeah.
And so it had to be, it wasn't that he was unable, or like Molly said, but wasn't able to know or able mm-hmm. to do. They chose. I think that's a good point.
I do too. And I think your point there is well taken.
because God cannot be tempted, nor can he tempt. But Jesus was tempted in all points as we are, but he was still God.
Is he saying the same thing here as he's saying in chapter 2, verse 9? When all the fullness of the Godhead
yeah.
is bodily?
I think that's what he's saying.
Is the exact same idea?
I believe that's really, it may be more than that, but that's kind of my take on it, at least.
Well, Christ, as you see me, you see the Father. So
mm-hmm.
that'd be pretty close.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. And he says in verse 20, to reconcile all things to himself, to bring back to peace, if you will, by him, whether things on earth or things in heaven, having made peace through the blood of his cross. And you, who once were alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now he has reconciled. Using that word again, reconcile. Verse 20, reconcile all things to himself, and you are part of that which has been reconciled to him. This is looking at Jesus as having that power, that authority, that right to reconcile us. Where they were minimizing him, Paul is showing him exactly what his authority, his right really was. He had that right and that authority to reconcile.
Do universalists use this as a try to push that? I mean, if everything is reconciled to him, you know, a sense of...
I could see where they would want to do that.
Reconciliation of all beings, you know.
Yeah, of all things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they certainly could do that. Not what he's talking about, but right. Let's let me grab the next two verses right quick, and we'll close right there. In the body of his flesh, notice that. What comes to mind?
Incarnation.
Right. And how does that go against the Gnostic teaching?
Oh, that flesh was evil.
There you go. So he's talking about that which was good and right, and made us pure, holy, reconciling us, was in his body. So his body couldn't have been evil, as they said. The body of his flesh through death to present you. And the idea here to present is to stand alongside. And I think the idea is he's reconciled you. You were enemies. He's reconciled you to God. It is as though he has set you beside God. None of that has yet happened or anything like that. But the idea is that relationship we now have with God. See, they're saying God's way out there. Nobody can ever reach him. Well, he says right here, in his flesh, when he died for you, shed his blood, that was forgiveness, and you entered into that relationship. You were like alongside of God at that time. His friend. Isn't that kind of the idea? Jesus talks about being the friend, his friend. So to present you holy and blameless and irreproachable in his sight. Okay. Then verse 23, if, conditional, if indeed you continue in the faith, I think he's talking about the system of faith, not a personal faith, but the body of truth. If you continue in the system of faith, grounded and steadfast. The idea here is like an edifice. And they had a lot of temples in that area. And, you know, deep foundations. So he's talking about here, if we continue in this system of faith, just like an edifice, having that foundation, and not moved away from the hope, and that means secure. So this earthquake comes, it's not going to move us or anything like that. Having that foundation away from the hope of the gospel, and that's the hope that's found in the gospel, which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven. Now that would either be in that known world at that time, or he's simply saying this truth that is just preached throughout the world. It's not this truth for this group of people, and that's true for that group of people. But it's throughout the whole world, which is preached to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister. Now let me share with you last thing here. Three characteristics which really authenticate faith. We really want to know what it is. Number one, it's what you heard from the apostles, or which you have heard in the Bible. Number two is what's preached throughout the whole world, every creature. It's the same message. So if I get a message that's foreign to what was preached by the apostles, it's found in the Bible, then wait a minute, there's something wrong here, because that same message has been preached throughout the whole world. And number three, of which I, Paul, became a minister. It has to be the message that was used throughout Paul's ministry. It kind of narrows it down, doesn't it? Any questions? We're out of time. Last moment. Comment?
Is it back in verse 22, when it talks about in the body of his flesh through death to present you? You talking about standing by you? Is it?
I think what he's saying here is this idea of being reconciled to God. Like their idea here is God way out here, and we have to go through all these channels with the Gnostics and everything till finally we will reach some point that God would recognize us. And I think he's saying, well, when Jesus died on the cross, shed his blood, there was that forgiveness. At that point, you were there with God at that point. He uses the word here, to present you. It's almost like, okay, here, Father, here's this one that's forgiven, who is alongside of you now.
Wondered if it meant then or in the future resurrection.
I think he's spiritually talking about then, that moment that it happens. Yes.
He really doesn't argue, in setting this forth, he doesn't really argue how the flesh can, is not sinful.
No.
And so it's kind of, it's the fact that God being in the flesh is a matter of revelation and not human reasoning whatsoever. Mm-hmm. He just simply says that it happened.
It happened, yeah. Yeah.
And maybe we should keep that in mind when we're trying to put pieces together about how it happened as well. It's a matter of revelation and not our reasoning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like going back to the creation. It happened. Okay. And it wasn't an explanation of all of that. It was God created. Yeah. And that kind of settles it. Very good. We'll drive a peg right there and pick up and
thank you.